Entering Kenmore, doors will open on the left.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to episode 6 of Entering Kenmore. I am David Azer alongside Zach Coe. Zach, it has been a hell of a few days. The dust has sort of settled. The Red Sox bring in Alex Bregman on a 3-year, $120 million contract with opt-outs in both the second and third year. This happened at Wednesday night at about like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. I had gotten home from working a shift, took an edible, was relaxing on the couch, watching some TV. What do I see on my phone? Well, my phone starts blowing up. I didn't know what the hell was going on because I was kind of, the room was spinning a bit, I'm not going to lie. And what do I see? But Jeff Passan. I don't think anyone was expecting this. In the last few weeks, we pretty much come to terms with they're not bringing him in. It may be an Arenado trade, or they're not doing anything else. But yeah, I gave Zach a call right when it happened. And it turns out he was also on another planet. So the emergency podcast had to wait a couple days to line up with our schedules. But we're here. We're ready to unpack this. And yeah, it is very exciting.
Yeah, I was playing some out of the park baseball, which, if you're not familiar, is a simulation baseball game on a spreadsheet. So I was running my expansion team, the Montreal MLB 32, with my buddy. So obviously that's a game that you take a couple edibles, smoke a joint or two, or take a couple hits out of a bowl and sit down and just get lost in being a giant loser, as I am playing a simulation baseball game, essentially spreadsheet baseball. And my phone's next to me, and all of a sudden it starts blowing up, and I look down at my phone, and my group chat with my buddies is like, "Oh, holy shit, holy fuck." I'm like, "What the fuck is going on here?" And I scroll down a little further in my notifications, and I see all the tweets like, "Bregman to the Red Sox." I'm like, what the fuck? Like you said, it's not something we were expecting at all. I had pretty much resigned myself to a Nolan Arenado trade. I know that was something that we talked about on here, something that neither of us were particularly interested in. I actually kind of talked myself into it, in the sense that based on all the reporting, it kind of sounded like they were going to buy Ivan Herrera, who I really like as a catcher, and he fills a hole on your roster. So, and Arenado does to a certain extent too, and as a defensive guy. And so I was like, all right, you can make this work as long as you're not giving anything up. And it seemed like it was like Nizan Zanatello or Blaze Jordan going the other way. So like, I like Blaze Jordan. I don't really know a whole lot about Zanatello, but if that's the return, then it is what it is. But nope, Craig has one final big move up his sleeve, and it's Alex Bregman, 3 years, 120 mil, 40 mil AAV, and then John Henry obviously posts, or not John Henry, but Linda Pizzuti posts that picture of him smoking the cigar right after.
That was so cold.
Yeah, so the bag man might be back.
Maybe. I think the biggest part of this deal is it just checks so many boxes for the Red Sox. You needed a veteran leader. You needed some defensive upgrades in the infield. And now you have a lot of versatility in the infield as well. You can start, I think the plan is to start Bregman at second. And then ultimately, when Campbell gets called up, you can kind of tinker with things then. And Devers, I think they're going to give him at least another half season to see if he can figure it out at third base, which I'm totally fine with. And then if Campbell comes up and starts hitting the piss out of the ball, then it's a good problem to have, I think. And the other aspect is you needed the veteran leader. We've been saying that all along. I think it is a very clear similarity between JD Martinez in 2018 and Alex Bregman now in 2025. And I don't want to be like, yeah, we're winning the division, but playoffs should be pretty likely at this point. And I'm tired of all the boomers. I'm tired of hearing them say, oh, $40 million is an overpay for Alex Bregman, who's put, you know, on the bad end of 30. But at this point, it's a 3-year deal. And if he, you know, if he hits the piss out of the ball next year and he wants to opt out and get a long-term deal somewhere else, then you're not on the hook for anything. I don't see a problem with this deal at all.
And it's free agency. You're going to have to overpay because it, and I heard, obviously I worked yesterday, I was working the phone lines for middays and afternoons, and I heard so many of those takes of the Bregman deal's trash. One caller tried to compare it to Adrian Gonzalez, and I was like, you, sir, are wrong. Adrian Gonzalez was good right up until the point that he blamed God for the 2011 Red Sox in the playoffs. So to compare him to Adrian Gonzalez would be, I'd be thrilled if he turned into Adrian Gonzalez. He was a multi-time all-star on the Red Sox. He led the league in doubles 1 year. He was good, but not to get on a Adrian Gonzalez tangent, but so many people said $40 million, but if they gave a 31-year-old Alex Bregman a 6-year deal, they also would have been shitting their pants. Like, how can you give this guy a 6-year deal for $27, $28 million a year? Well, like, that's the alternative in today's baseball. Either you give the years or you give the dollars. And they gave the dollars. And, like, ultimately, who gives a shit? It's not my money. Like, it's not my $40 million. So for anyone else to be upset about that, like, just, like, stop. Like, stop. Why do you care? It's not your money. It's a good player. He fills holes that you desperately, desperately needed. And, like, as early as this week, we had Craig Breslow saying it's an incomplete roster. Now it's not.
Yeah, and there still could be a couple moves to be made, maybe bring in a bullpen arm, which I know was floated. I think Bradford floated that on Jones and Keefe yesterday. But another aspect of this that I've seen a lot of people talking about is just how well Breslow read the market in this scenario. Like, he did not want to bring in Bregman on a 6-year deal.
Nor should
and he. Exactly. And Bregman wanted that. Bregman wanted the long-term security. This likely could have been his last big deal. And ultimately, Breslow waited out the market. He realized that really the only other key players were the Cubs and the Tigers. And those teams are a lot worse. Their outlook is a lot worse than the Red Sox. Maybe the Tigers are a little bit better, but even still, a right-handed hitter at Comerica Park in a kind of prove-it deal is not going to turn out great. So
he just really did not want to play for the Tigers, it seems like.
No.
Because they offered him 6 and 170, and he was like, I'm all fucking set on that.
Which is like, yeah, the Tigers are an up-and-coming team, but to play at Comerica Park for 81 games a year in such a pitcher-friendly ballpark, I understand why he's like, nah, I don't want to fuck with that. And I think ultimately he wanted to come to the Red Sox the entire time, and he was really pushing for that. And Breslow stood his ground, and I am very happy with the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, like you said earlier, it seems like he's going to play second base. Personally, that's not where I would be playing him. I'd be playing him at third and moving Devers to DH. But for whatever reason, we know that's been a sticking point of the entire offense or offseason. And even Cora, in his first sit down with the media when they were doing the picnic table availabilities on Tuesday, said, you know, like, that's a conversation that if we have it, we're going to have with Rafi first. He's worked his ass off all offseason to try and get better. But as of right now, Rafael Devers is the third baseman of the Boston Red Sox. I just don't understand why, like, if Devers hadn't gotten paid yet, I understand the sticking point of, I'm a third baseman, I want to play third base because when it comes time to get paid, I want to get paid like a third baseman, not like a DH. You've been paid. And you're a terrible, not only are you a terrible defensive third baseman, you always get hurt playing defense. So, like, why are you going to take yourself off the field for something that, like, they didn't pay you $330 million to play third base. They paid you that money to go out there and challenge for 40 bombs every year and 100 RBIs and be the anchor of the offense. So why is this a big sticking point for you? You got your money. Your value comes entirely from your bat. And I know Coley has said this a whole lot on the 10. They paid him not one of those dollars for his defense. Not a single one. So, like, I don't understand the sticking point. And while Bregman playing second base does make your team better, it just seems like there's another level that you can get to with Bregman at third, Devers at DH, and then letting Campbell and Grissom battle it out for that second base job, which now we've kind of been robbed of. And don't get me wrong, I'm happy that we've been robbed of that spring training storyline to get Bregman in, because I'll take that trade off. But that was something I was looking forward to, because eventually you're going to have to find a place for these guys to play. And I'm obviously not concerned about Campbell finding a place to play, because he's the type of talent that is just going to, like, when he's, if he starts the year in AAA, and I'll get into that in a little bit, because I still think there's a path for him to make the opening day roster. If he's in AAA and he's hitting the shit out of the ball, they're going to find a spot for him. I don't know if you can say the same for Vaughn Grissom, and I kind of want to see what we have in him, because that trade just looks so bad with Chris Sale winning the Cy Young and him doing nothing for you.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point. I think another aspect of the Devers debate in general is I'm okay with giving him another half season or so to sort of prove whether or not he can play third base. At least you have the backup plan in-house now, rather than being like the whole conversation all offseason was, we don't want Devers playing third and we have no backup plan. So at least if it does go to shit again, then you can just slot Bregman in there and figure it out later. But yeah, I am interested to see if, I know it's in the notes too, but if another move is coming, because like you said, Campbell could find his way to an opening day spot, but if it's not at second base, it would probably have to be in the outfield. And there is still a hell of a logjam out there. So I am curious. I know that I mentioned that Bradford said maybe some other, you know, more supplemental moves are coming. I don't know how big of a trade we could see with, you know, a month and change left until spring training or until the season starts. But yeah, there is a lot of options. You still have sort of an embarrassment of riches in your farm system. And I think there is a means to make a big trade. I don't know how likely that is though.
Yeah. Especially it seems like the only smoke that was left on the trade market was coming from San Diego between their two soon to be free agent pitchers, Dylan Cease and Michael King. And I don't know who had the initial report. I saw it on MLB Trade Rumors, but it seems like they were both staying to start the year, even after they signed Nick Pivetta to that deal, which we haven't even touched on yet. Another good play of the market by Craig Breslow to get the comp pick for him and then immediately say, fuck this pick, and give it right back to Houston for Bregman. But they also signed 2020 Red Sox legend Kyle Hart, who is coming off of the KBO Cy Young last year. And so he's coming back stateside. I actually saw a piece with Cotillo. This is kind of a side tangent. Cotillo did a feature on Kyle Hart earlier in the offseason when he first decided to come back stateside. And he was like, yeah, dude, it was embarrassing when I was out of baseball for a little bit there, because people used to talk to me and I used to be like, oh yeah, like I played in the majors a little bit, and I didn't want to tell them my name because they'd look me up and I'd have like a fucking 8 ERA. So good for Kyle Hart for going over to Korea. A little bit of an Eric Fetty, maybe this year's Eric Fetty, taking that path, going over, rebuilding his game, coming back and having success in the big leagues. But that was my Kyle Hart tangent. But it seems like both of those guys, Cease and King, are going to be staying put. I floated this yesterday before I saw that maybe a Cease and King trade along with Robert Suarez for something like Cutter and Willier Abreu to give the Padres some controllable assets to move forward with, because we know they're in pretty much shambles since their owner died last season. But it doesn't seem like that's super likely. I think there's still a hole in the bullpen. Craig Breslow on Tuesday said that they were looking for someone who could generate swings and misses and has experience pitching in the back end of games. I don't know where you get that at this point in the off season. If it's not a trade, like David Robertson still floating out there, but that's kind of more of what you have. And I know we're going to get into the bullpen discussion shortly, but I think there's still a hole there, but I don't know what move is left to be made out there.
Yeah, yeah, it is a little unfortunate that they waited this long to, I mean, I'm fine, like, obviously I'm happy they brought in Bregman, but there was a couple months where they made the Crochet trade in, what was that, early January or late December? I don't know.
Yeah, it was right after Creed signed.
Okay, yeah, so, and then they just went on for a bunch of time not doing anything, and during that time, Tanner Scott, Kirby Yates, some other big bullpen guys all went off the board, mostly to the Dodgers. and you just kind of stood there and watched. And that was a big hole. That was something of need that you knew that you wanted to figure out this offseason, and they kind of just didn't. They were like, okay, Aroldis Chapman, terrible person. We're going to sign him right off the bat. So
and set the no market one cares. On him.
Yeah, yeah, with the $10 million deal that looks worse and worse every time you another reliever gets signed. If that's your only move in the bullpen, I'm just not sold. I know that I think you told me, right, that Breslow and Cora were kind of disagreeing on whether or not they wanted their bullpen guys to have solidified roles or whether it was a mix and match type thing. To me, I would much rather see them have solidified roles. I think that just gives you a lot more comfortability rather than like, okay, Slayton, you get the ninth this time. Hendricks, you're going to get the ninth a different day. I just hate that. I don't like messing with the relievers' kind of mojo and their routine. I think you should just have solidified guys, figure it out, and go from there.
Yeah, they contradicted each other twice on two pretty big points in their opening pressers of spring, once on the six-man rotation and then once in that bullpen. Breslow said that they were comfortable with Slayton, Chapman, Hendricks, Whitlock, and for some reason he said Justin Wilson in high-leverage spots. he said that they could mix and match those guys in late in games, and Cora got asked if he still believes in defined roles in the bullpen because that's kind of how he's operated pretty much since he's been here, and he said yes. So I don't really know what their plan for the bullpen is as far as defined roles go. Like, do you start the season with Hendricks as your closer and then Chapman as your eighth inning guy, and then if Hendricks falters, you give Chapman a try? My dark horse to be closer by the All-Star break is Justin Slayton. I think he's going to take over that role.
Yeah, yeah, that's not a bad take at all. I think they trust him a lot for a guy that was a Rule 5 pick like Garrett Whitlock, but only last year, and he showed a ton of success and growth all of last year. They definitely trusted him more and more as the year went on, and now you don't have Kenley Jansen in the back end of your bullpen, so it opens up a door for Slayton. I do think they're going to lean Hendricks, like you said, early, because he has the closing experience. Obviously, he hasn't pitched in a while, but I would feel more comfortable starting the year with Hendricks there, seeing if he still has anything, and then if not, I think you kick it over to Slayton. I do not want to see Aroldis Chapman closing games at all.
Yeah, that's a heart attack. We did Craig Kimbrell. I don't need to see Aroldis Chapman. I understand the gist of what that looks like.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen it plenty of times against the Astros in the ALCS. I don't need to see that on my team. I am all set.
Yeah, and just going back to Slayton, I mean, there's so many things to like about what you saw from him. Just looking at his Savant page right now, there's a whole lot of red. He's 86th percentile fastball velo, 97th percentile chase rate, 76th percentile whiff percentage, right around in that same area in strikeout percentage. And we talk about Aroldis Chapman being a heart attack closer because he doesn't know where the ball's going. 97th percentile walk rate, just 4% walk rate for Justin Slayton last year. So when you talk about when Breslow says what kind of characteristics you're looking for in the back end of the bullpen, a guy who generates swings and misses, who misses bats, doesn't allow a whole lot of barrels. That's another thing that Slayton does well. He's 96th percentile barrel percentage at 3.9%. So he does have a lot of those traits. And like you said, they showed a whole lot of trust in him, at least throughout all of last season, similar to the way that they did with Whitlock in 2021. So I think eventually when everybody else falters, he's going to kind of take command of that closer role.
Yeah, two things off of that. One is Slayton's only 27. And they've mentioned that they kind of want to build the bullpen from in-house. If you can trust Slayton as your closer or a late inning reliever, that's a guy you're going to have for a decent chunk of time. And also going off the Whitlock thing, I heard yesterday that Cora mentioned he noticed that he was sort of returning to his 2021 form. Mm-hmm. He looks a bit different physically, but you know, the velo's there again. and all of that, and he looks comfortable again. So I am pretty optimistic. I liked Garrett Whitlock a lot in 2021. I liked how they used him. I thought it was a really smart way of doing things, and then they just fucked it all up by trying to make him a starter, and he hasn't been the same since. But I am pretty confident that Garrett Whitlock can be a multi-inning guy and stay healthy for a majority of the season next year.
Yeah, one of the things Cora said yesterday, because like I said, I was working, so I listened to all those press conferences, partially because I'm interested in it, partially because it's my job. But he said that the stuff was pretty much back to 2021 Whitlock, but he had a little bit more velo. So, like, obviously that's encouraging to hear when you talk about a guy who, like you said, was a really lethal weapon for them out of the bullpen, going two or three innings when they absolutely had to. And I think he even closed out that 2021 wild card game against the Yankees. So he does have a little bit of closing experience. I don't know how much you want to lean on him closing out games, because he does give you that versatility for two to three innings, even if you don't have to use him in a high leverage spot, like, say, I don't know, let's just pick a guy who is in the, who gets shelled a lot. Cutter Crawford gives you three innings, three bombs, and you're behind in the game, and you're sitting here in the third inning going, fuck, how are we gonna get through the rest of this one? It's like, okay, well, Witt can give us three. That brings you to the sixth, and then you can kind of figure out where you're at from there, whether you need to dip into those high leverage arms or go to some of the scrubs at the front end of your bullpen in mop up role. But, and then you can also, like we said, deploy him in those high leverage spots. If you have Slayton and Hendricks down, or any combination of those high leverage guys down, it's like, all right, well, Whitlock's got the seventh and the eighth, and we can toss it over to whoever for the ninth, or however you want to do it. So he gives you a lot of options. And I know we're going to talk about the six man rotation, but he also gives you a lot of options there in kind of pushing back some of the issues with pushing back against some of the issues that people have with a six man rotation, namely your bullpen is an arm short.
Right. Right. And I don't know how much I like the idea of doing a six man rotation. Me personally, I would rather just put Cutter Crawford in the bullpen and hope he figures it out there. Sort of like a Josh Winkowski kind of thing in what was that? Was that 2020 now, or is that later than that? Maybe 22,
okay, somewhere around there.
Yeah, around there. But point being, I don't like Cutter Crawford as a starter, and now that you have the depth to not put him in the starting rotation, I would much prefer them to just let him see what he's got in the bullpen, and if not, then maybe his trade value takes a hit. But at this point, it's like, I don't see him as a long-term rotation solution unless he fixes the homer problem, which has been a consistent thing now for going on 2 years. So yeah, and I think I saw that Cutter got an injury today. I can look for it, but
yeah, I'll pick up where you left off there while you look for that. But I'm kind of surprised Cutter's still on this team, because like you said, the home run problem continues to pop up for him. I know it looked like for the first month of the season he had that under control, but alas, he did not, because he didn't allow a home run for the first month of the season and then led the league in both home runs allowed and homers per nine the rest of the way. I think there was a stretch there in the middle of the season where obviously it's a little hotter, the ball starts carrying, he gave up, it was like 12 home runs in like 16 innings or something like that. So obviously not what you're looking for, but I also just don't know how well that type of profile fits at a park like Fenway Park, because when you're looking at the baseball savant park factors, Fenway is one of the more hitter-friendly parks in the league. Not only that, they're also the most homer-friendly or second most homer-friendly park in the league because of the monster. So that's a guy that I kind of expected to be on the move when the homer problem didn't go away, because I just don't know. Like I said, I don't know how that profile fits at Fenway for half the season when you give up that many home runs, unless they believe that there's something that they can do to limit that kind of hard contact and limit guys getting the ball in the air. But even last year, he was just 7th percentile ground ball percentage, 33.8% of batted balls are on the ground. So this is a guy that's giving up a whole lot of balls in the air, and he really is middle of the pack in terms of whiff rate and strikeout rate. So I just don't know where you go from here with him.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the intangibles are there. It's the homer problem that really is key, and I was curious, if they did trade him, would his stuff play better in a pitcher-friendly ballpark, maybe a San Francisco, a St. Louis, you know, a Seattle? Obviously, they wouldn't want to want to make a move for him, but I just don't see the fit in Boston, really. I do have the injury updates, though, from Chris Cotillo. So he said Cutter Crawford is a bit behind other pitchers due to patellar tendon soreness, and opening day is definitely not ruled out there. And then he also said Bayo has some minor shoulder soreness and was shut down for a couple of days, but now he's back to throwing. So I don't know how much of an issue that will be. It's just something I saw earlier today.
Yeah, that's to be expected, obviously, as guys are just reporting. They go through their off-season programs and then get back to start ramping things up. Like, I'm not expecting a clean bill of health throughout the entire spring training. It doesn't seem like that's anything that is going to necessarily linger. But and when you talk about Cutter, this is a guy that has you have team control of through 2029, so that's definitely attractive to other teams. And when we talk about that logjam, it feels like Willier Abreu and Cutter Crawford were in every single trade proposal that was on Red Sox Twitter all offseason. So I am a little bit surprised to see those guys still here, especially when we know how coveted guys with control, like cheap controllable assets, are. So that does kind of surprise me. I'm interested to see what they do with him. It seems like they're at least considering the six-man rotation, but you'd have to imagine that if they do decide to go with the five, that he's the odd man out.
Right, right. And also, I was thinking just while you were talking there, I would almost prefer a Richard Fitz or a Quinn Priester in that six-man role, like the bottom of the rotation, just because I feel like they have more upside at this point. And I was also thinking maybe they're just kicking the can down the road at this point, and maybe come trade deadline, if they need to make a move, maybe in the bullpen or, you know, just make a salary dump type move, maybe they could attach an Abreu or a Crawford there. So they still have options. I don't know how I would feel about, you know, attaching a Yoshida salary dump, for example, with a Cutter Crawford or an Abreu
who
has value. Yeah, like that was the same conversation when they were trying to do that with Casas to the Mariners. So I don't know. I think they do have a lot of options there, and I'm kind of okay with them just seeing how things shape out rather than, like, we have a logjam, let's move these guys the second we're able to. And I don't know if their value will really go down that much.
Yeah, and that's what's great. Well, relatively great about baseball is that all these sort of logjam issues tend to sort themselves out because guys are going to get hurt. Like, there's going to be an injury in the bullpen or in the rotation. There's going to be an injury in the fields. There's going to be ways. I mean, we talked about Christian Campbell a little bit ago, now potentially being blocked at second base. Trevor Story is going to be hurt by April Fool's Day. So, like, that's going to open up a spot right there. Like, these things are going to sort themselves out. Like, they're going to figure it out. Like, guys are going to get hurt. Guys are going to have to step up back into those roles, whether it be Cutter Crawford moving from the bullpen back into the rotation, or them shortening the rotation from a six man to a five man when someone goes down. And we haven't even touched on the relative unknown that is Lucas Giolito coming back from Tommy John this year. So that's another question mark in there. So I do think there's something to be said for keeping Cutter when you don't know what you're going to get from Giolito just yet.
Yeah. And it also, on the offensive side, with Rafaela being like essentially a super utility guy now, you can afford a Trevor Story injury, which is pretty much inevitable at this point, and still have a very solid defensive outfield if Roman Anthony gets called up, or if Abreu, Duran, and like Ref Snyder or someone else plays out there, or even Campbell if he pans out right away. So I'm kind of okay with the embarrassment of riches. I do think a move will have to be made, whether that's at the trade deadline or next offseason. But for now, I'm happy with the product we're seeing right now.
Yeah, you can kind of map things out a little bit, and I think the Bregman option at the end of this year plays a big role in that. Does he leave 2 years, $80 million on the table at 31 years old? I find that hard to believe, but does he think there's another 6-year deal out there? Or I guess maybe at that point, another 5-year deal out there. Like, it's obvious that he didn't want to go to Detroit. So is there a team other than the Tigers that is willing to say, like, all right, we saw you for a year in Boston, here's 5 years, 30 mil, here's five, and whatever that math works out to. I'm not a numbers guy. 150. 5-150. Like that. Yeah, quick maths. Does a team say that? I can't imagine so after he's a year older, no. Unless he just completely comes in and lights the world on fire, which, like, if that's the case, if he comes in and has a good enough season to where he's opting out of 2 years, $80 million, then you say, thank you for your services. We went to the World Series. You were a big part of that, and we appreciate what you've done. And you just let him go out there and seek a longer term deal. Like, it's a win-win. And I kind of feel like that's being lost on people because they just see the huge price tag of $40 million.
Yeah. I do want to mention two quick things here on that is, I think $30 million of this deal is deferred. So it ultimately is a $90 million like cap hit or whatever you call it in baseball at this point. So one, that gives you a little bit more financial flexibility if you want to bring in another cheap bullpen option. And two, I still think that means they went over the CBT, right?
I believe so. It brings them real close if they're not over it. But at that point, like, things are going to happen over the course of the season. You're going to bring guys in off of waivers. You're going to call players up, things like that. So, like, I would guess that they're going to go over, which I feel like we kind of glossed over this point when we initially talked about Bregman. We talked when they signed or traded for Crochet that this is the opening of your championship window. That window is now wide open. You don't make a move like this, what could amount to be a 1 year, $40 million deal for a guy like Alex Bregman, if you're not planning to contend this year. And when you're planning to contend, this is when you should be open or going beyond that luxury tax threshold for the first time and starting that clock, because we know the penalties progressively get worse every year you're beyond it. So now we're talking about a team that should at least be in the World Series, if not winning one, within the next 3 years. And that's exciting to think about because, like we said, when you look at every single great Red Sox team, there are homegrown talent supplemented with outside additions, whether it be in 2018, you have Bogarts and Mookie and a little bit of Devers, Jackie Bradley Jr., Benintendi, supplemented by JD Martinez, Chris Sale, Craig Kimbrell. And maybe you don't have the Craig Kimbrell type because he was still a really elite closer in that season, but you can kind of start to see the framework come together of the next great Red Sox team between Bregman and the big three coming up, supplemented by Garrett Crochet, Brian Bayo, players like that, the Tanner Houck. So it is exciting to think about. And honestly, like, at this point, if you're not in the ALCS, I think this year, then you can call this season a pretty big disappointment, because when you look around the AL, who really scares you? Like, I think maybe the Yankees didn't get worse with the additions that they had, but last year they were a two-man lineup between Aaron Judge and Juan Soto. Obviously, they lose Soto to the Mets. They replace him with Cody Bellinger, who I like just fine. And a full season of Jazz Chisholm in Yankee Stadium should play well with the short porch. But does aging Cody Bellinger and Jazz Chisholm equate to Juan Soto? I don't think so. And you add Max Fried. So now you have Cole and Fried and then a bunch of whatever beneath him. So that's the team that went to the World Series last year. The Orioles didn't get better. They got worse. They lost Corbin Burns and Anthony Santander, replaced him with Tyler O'Neill, which I know they're moving the left field walls back in for Tyler O'Neill. but I don't know what kind of impact he has there. I mean, we saw it last year. He hits a lot of solo home runs. So we'll see what he does. We'll see what their pitching staff looks like. It looks like they're going to be leaning on Grayson Rodriguez to be the anchor of that staff, but who knows if he's going to be able to answer that bell. And then across the rest of the league, the Astros have already taken a step back. The Guardians we kind of know what they are. They're a one-man lineup with a really good pitching staff. Same can be said out in Seattle. The real dark horse that nobody's looking at is Texas with Semien and Seager and hopefully a full season of DeGrom, things like that. But other than that, like, there's no reason you can't be contending for a World Series spot, if not being the AL representative in the World Series.
Yeah, a couple things to add there is the Orioles lost Corbin Burns and they replaced him with 40-year-old Charlie Morton. There was a caller a couple days ago who was like, oh, why are we so optimistic about the Red Sox? Like, they're still going to be third to last in their division. And I was like, okay, let's map this out. because I think you're 100% wrong. The Yankees got worse, whether you want to admit it or not. They brought in pretty much the corpse of Paul Goldschmidt at this point and Cody Bellinger, who I think his best years are far behind. And then the Orioles got significantly worse. They lost their ace, and now they're leaning on Grayson Rodriguez, like you said, who's been injured pretty consistently. Like, I don't think he finished the year with them. And, I mean, the Blue Jays are bad. I don't think they're getting a Vladdy Jr. extension done. The Rays are the Rays. They brought in Ha-Seong Kim. But other than that, I'm not scared of them. I mean, McClanahan's coming back, but we'll see if that has any impact. But, yeah, like you said, the American League is wide open. And I was also kind of thinking this lineup seems a little bit more even balanced than the 2018 lineup. Like, the bottom half of your order in 2018 was Eduardo Nunez, Ian Kinsler, and Jackie Bradley Jr., who, when he was on, he was good. But when he was
ALCS MVP, Jackie Bradley.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So in the playoffs, he was good. I'll give you that. But, I mean, I think Eduardo Nunez hit like an inside the park home run in some playoff series that year. But point being, you have a second baseman now, and whether that's your long-term answer at second base or not, it is the best second baseman you've had since Dustin Pedroia.
And that's a guy that Cora actually compared Bregman to yesterday. Yeah. And mm-hmm. he played the whole, like, oh, I can't comment on deals that aren't official, which it seems like this deal might be made official here today, because as I looked on Twitter for this potential lineup, I saw a whole bunch of videos of Alex Bregman on a golf cart driving around JetBlue in the facilities down there. So he's he's there to take the physical and I assume sign the contract. And maybe either today or tomorrow we get the whole, because I assume when you're handing out $40 million contracts, they're going to do the whole press conference where he's holding up the jersey. Which it'll be nice to see that finally come to fruition. We haven't had that in so long. And even
I know
Garrett Crochet's first media availability was over Zoom in the in the couple days in the wake of the trade. But excuse me, the potential lineup here, like you said, it's so much more deeper. This one comes from Fox. Duran, Devers, Bregman, Casas, Story, Yoshida, Abreu, Wong, Rafaela. Willier Abreu is your 7-hole hitter. And I just, like, it can get even better with one of Roman Anthony and Christian Campbell in that 9-hole over Seydon Rafaela. This has Duran in left and Rafaela in center. And I'm kind of all set on the Rafaela being a starter on this team, especially if I think now that conversation of Grissom and Campbell battling out for second base becomes Campbell and Anthony battling it out for left field, because I think there's a pretty high possibility that at least one of those two guys comes in and has a, what is it, 2012 Jackie Bradley Jr. type of spring training.
Something like that, yeah.
Where he just absolutely tore the cover off the ball and forced their hand onto the opening day roster. Now, on the flip side, you could say, Zach, what happened to Jackie Bradley Jr. in 2012? He fizzled out in the first 2 months and had to get sent back down. But that's a risk I'm willing to take because of the new incentivization of having your top prospects on your roster sooner. And I do worry that they're going to Pirates this up with how the Pirates mishandled Paul Skeens. So if you don't know what happened with them, you have a certain day that I think it's May 2nd or something like that. It's sometime in May where you can call up your top prospects and gain an extra year of service time. In the new CBA, along with the compensation pick incentivization for the players, they gain a full year of service time no matter what if they win the Rookie of the Year. But if you call up your player past that date, they're not eligible for the draft pick anymore. So the Pirates played that game with Paul Skeens. They waited until May, whatever, to call him up. They were no longer eligible for the draft pick compensation, but they were willing to make that sacrifice in exchange for an extra year of Paul Skeens under control. Logically makes sense, but what does Paul Skeens come out and do? He comes out and drops his nuts on the table, wins the Rookie of the Year award, gains a full year of service time, and the Pirates get screwed out of that pick. I think that is liable to happen to the Red Sox with one of Campbell or Anthony if one of them isn't on the opening day roster. So I've seen enough of Seidon Rafaela. I know what he is. He's a plus-plus defender with a questionable bat and swing decisions that haven't improved really at all in his courses of time as a prospect and then over the course of last year. So I don't know why it seems like people are just writing him in Sharpie into this opening day lineup, especially when you have these types of talents there. But I'm more than okay with him opening the season in that super utility role. And like you said, Trevor Story's going to get hurt and he's going to be your shortstop. So, like,
yeah,
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I'm fine with him being your shortstop. I think that is an important part of a championship team is the super utility role. You saw with Brock Holt, he could give pretty much anyone a day off whenever they needed it and still be a decent at bat and still be a pretty good defender. And I can see Rafaela being in that role and excelling in that role because they mix and matched him so much last year where he was playing short one game, then he would be in center the next and, you know, what have you. So I think he's okay with doing that. And maybe we'll see that on a larger scale. But like you said, I don't think that should take away from bringing up one of these top prospects, especially now that you don't have to lean on them nearly as much as you did before you had Bregman. Like, people were talking as Christian Campbell was like their off-season right-handed bat acquisition, which should not be the case for however old he is. What is he, like 20, 21?
He's 23. He's the oldest of the bunch because he's a college bat.
Right, right. Okay. So yeah, a 23-year-old guy should not be leaned on that much. And now you can slot him in the bottom third of your lineup and just see what happens. Like, you're not pulling a Jackson Holliday being like, oh, you tore the cover off the ball in AAA and now we want to see you absolutely destroy major league pitching. Like, go for it. And then it doesn't pan out. You are totally fine to not rush these guys along, but also see them fail at the major league level.
Right.
Which I think we mentioned a couple episodes ago where that is much rather what I would want to see.
Right. And it goes back to something that Alex Cora said, and I can't remember when it was, whether it be at the Fenway Winter Fest or whatever they called it, or somewhere else through another media outlet. But he, when talking about the prospects, said these prospects aren't here to be saviors. They're here to contribute in their rookie year, but we can't look at them as saviors. And like you said, that's kind of how people were looking at them. And that's kind of how it was being reported that the front office was looking at these guys, where when we got those reports that Kennedy and Cora wanted Bregman, but Breslow was a little bit more hesitant because he thinks that Christian Campbell can give you the same output as Alex Bregman over the long term, which, like, I think is true. Like, I think in the next 3 years, Christian Campbell's going to be a better baseball player than Alex Bregman. Like, that's just the nature of the sport. We're talking about, I looked it up, Campbell's 22, going to be 23 in June. So, like, we're talking about a kid that's coming up and starting his career versus a guy who we have heard through various channels throughout the offseason is worried about his legacy and cementing himself as a potential Hall of Fame player. Like, these are obviously two guys at different points in his career, and it's nice to see that it's not like, all right, Christian Campbell, you're the opening day second baseman of the Boston Red Sox. We lost our right-handed bopper. Go out there and sock 20 home runs, hit 30 doubles, hit 310, and run away with Rookie of the Year. It's now like you said, with Jackson Holliday, he can come up, he can struggle. If need be, he can go back down, kind of make adjustments on where he struggled, and then come back up and actually become a productive ball player, because that's exactly what happened with Holliday. And they say the biggest jump in the minors is going from single A to double A because the pitchers are so much better. But the jump from triple A to the majors is even bigger than that, because triple A is in such a weird spot between having top prospects like your Myers, like your Campbells, like your, I can't think of any pitchers in triple A that are top prospects off the top of my head right now. I guess
maybe like Skeens, Andrew Painter.
Skeens would have been one of them last year, and quad A guys that are just kind of hanging on for dear life, like hoping they can get another chance in the bullpen or pick up a spot start here and there. So it's a weird area to be in, and I would like to see them start the year on the opening day roster. If they fail and need to go back down, that's fine with me. That's just the nature of the game. But
it's a good point. And yeah, just kind of going off of that, where people were like, we want Campbell to be the savior and he can fill that Bregman role if you don't get him. What if you have both in your lineup? Like, right. That is a lot. That is just a lot better in my mind than, oh, let's just rely on Christian Campbell. Like, if you have both of them in your lineup, you have Bregman in the middle of your lineup, you have Campbell slowly figuring it out at the bottom. Like, the upside of this lineup is something we haven't seen from a Red Sox team since 2018.
Not to mention, I think putting Jarren Duran in left field is just a disgusting use of his defense. I mean, obviously you're talking about Willy Abreu, a guy who won the Gold Glove in right field last year. And we know that right field at Fenway is pretty much center field at other ballparks. But we're talking about a guy in Duran who was 95th percentile outs above average, 11. He was 87th percentile arm value, 2. I don't really know what that one means fully. But and then 75th percentile arm strength, averaging 88.2 miles an hour on his throws in. So like stick him in front of the wall and left feels really gross, especially when you consider what Rafael is going to be giving you with his bat, which is, as we know, going to be next to nothing. He's going to pop a couple big home runs here and there, but he's also going to strike out like 30% of the time. And I know the defensive metrics don't show it out well on Savant from last year because of the switching around from positions that he did, but I do know they like him better as a center fielder. It feels like when you have a guy who is maybe not worse defensively, but like at best as good defensively as Jarren Duran, it also gives you next to nothing with the bat, and you have two top prospects that I think Anthony probably is a left fielder.
Yeah.
When it's all said and done, and Campbell's probably still an infielder, but you have two guys who are a little bit more questionable out there in the outfield in terms of defense and can also hopefully provide you much more at bat than Rafaela. Then it seems like that left field job should be one of theirs for the taking, with Duran moving over to center. And like we said, Rafaela in the super utility.
Yeah, like it makes too much sense, and I wonder if that's how it will shape out just after getting to spring training and seeing how everyone looks. I wonder if a lot of this has just been smoke because no one really knows what's happening with no storylines. But yeah, spring training is going to be super interesting, especially with all these top prospects possibly earning spots. I don't know, like, do you want to put a percentage on it? I don't really know where I'm at on that.
On one of them starting the season?
Yeah.
I think there's a 100% chance that we see one of Christian Campbell or Roman Anthony on the opening day roster. I think that just one of them, we've seen it so many times with these top prospects where they just come in and they light the world on fire in spring training and force their hands. So I think one of those two guys, and like when you hear quotes from them, I've seen a lot of Campbell quotes and a couple from Anthony, that they're hungry to get up to the big leagues and they want to contribute to this roster. And I just think that they, even you can lump Meyer into that category. I know he's a little bit of an afterthought because you don't know where he's going to play, and he actually hasn't even taken a single AAA at bat yet. So I think there's a 0% chance that he's on the opening day roster. But with those two guys specifically, it just feels like one of them is going to just hit the shit out of the ball and be like, all right, what are you going to do? You can't not put me on this opening day roster. And I think it definitely helps that if one of them does do that and take command of the job, that there's a draft pick compensation waiting for them at the other end. Like, I don't really care about the extra year service time. It'd be nice to have, but like I said, I think there's a fair chance that if you call one of those guys up on May 15th, that they just win the rookie of the year anyways, get their extra year service time, and you don't get your pick. So I'd rather just see them there, see what they can do. And if you need to go the Jackson Holiday route of, okay, this didn't work out on your first go back down there, work on this, this, and this, and then come back up and be a really productive player, then that's fine too. Development isn't linear. It never has been for prospects. And I think not enough people remember that. People just expect these guys, like Cora said, to come up and be the savior of the team. And obviously the pressure's not on them to do that anymore with Bregman here, but I think the pressure is going to be on themselves to try to do that. Obviously, like, they're not immune to the noise. So if they come up and struggle and need to go back down, I'm okay with that. Like, not every prospect is Paul Skeens, where like he's in AAA throwing like no hitters every game, every 5 days. Yeah. And everyone's sitting there saying, what are the Pirates doing? Like, I think more guys than not are going to come up and initially fail at the major league level.
Absolutely. And another aspect of that is we've seen Craig Breslow really values his draft picks, because the second Pivetta signed that deal with the Padres, he was like, all right, $40 million for Bregman, I don't care anymore. So I do think they'll play it right. I don't think they're going to pull the Pirates. I don't think they're going to mess around with service time too much. They're the Boston Red Sox. Their championship window is now open, and they should be doing however they feel is best with these prospects. And I do think that one of them will start the year. I don't think both will.
No, I can't imagine both would, because where do you play the other one? Unless an injury happens during camp that opens up a spot for both of them. But like, it's not worth it to have, say, Roman Anthony be your starting left fielder and Christian Campbell coming off the bench. It's more valuable to have one of those two guys in AAA getting regular.
Exactly. I think we have one more thing to touch on, and that is what the hell did we do with Masataka Yoshida?
Yeah, it's a tough one, because they did the same thing. Cora did the same thing this year that they did last year with his defense, being like, oh, well, like, we only didn't play him out there because of health. Like, he only didn't play any outfield for health reasons. Like, that's why he was stuck at DH. But, and obviously last year, Breslow said that he thought the metrics didn't tell the whole story with Yoshida's defense. But we also know that they hate him. Like, we know that they do not. If they could pick one player on their own roster to fire into the sun, it would be Masataka Yoshida. And
oh, yeah.
I like Yoshida the player. I've had this conversation so many times with people that Yoshida, as a bat at the surface level, he hits well against righties. He's patient at the plate. He's not going to strike out a whole lot. He's going to get on base. And those last two things are something that the Red Sox obviously struggled with a whole lot last year. They were second or third in the league in strikeouts, and they didn't walk a whole lot. So that type of bat adds value to your lineup, but he doesn't play the field. He has no versatility. And is that type of bat where, like, he might hit like anywhere between 280 to 300 on the high end and have a OBP in the, what, 360 range?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, and like, at what's his ceiling for power? Like 15 home runs? Is that a guy that you're willing to trot out there at your DH every single day? No, it's not.
No.
And that's where the issue comes in. And I know, obviously, the Red Sox organization and Red Sox fans, given the great history we've had with DHs, obviously with Ortiz and then JD Martinez, are fine trotting out an everyday DH, but other teams aren't as willing to do that. They like to mix and match their DH. They like to give their best hitter days off from the field, get them off their feet, but keep their bat in the lineup by DHing them. So it just kind of leaves them between a rock and a hard place, where you're okay kind of having his bat there, but do you use a bench spot now on a guy that you don't want to DH and no other team's willing to give you anything for him? I mean, fuck, the fucking Mariners weren't even willing to take him on with Tristan Casas attached to it.
That's insane. Like,
yeah, like, I mean, Jerry DePoto is on the fast track to getting fired over there. But, like, I understand, like, that's a stupid organization making a stupid move. But, like, if the Red Sox are willing to attach Tristan Casas to Masataka Yoshida to just get him the fuck out of here, what does that say about how they view him? Like, I just... Exactly. It feels like we're just heading down the DFA track.
Yeah, which, at this point, I'm kind of okay with. If you can get nothing for him, like, if it's just a full salary dump with, like, just cash considerations coming back, or, you know, international player pool, I'm fine with that. If, as long as it just get him, at this point, I just want to free up the roster spot. And I was thinking about this too, like you mentioned, you cannot have, you know, 15 home runs per season as your DH. You just can't. Like, DH is a power hitter. It always has been. I just don't see a spot for him anymore. And to me, his days are just getting more and more numbered with more people they bring in, especially when Anthony and Campbell and Meyer, whenever he does, gets called up. Like, he just will not have a spot.
Yeah, and that's what you say. Like, you're obviously willing to temporarily block one of those guys for somebody like Alex Bregman and what he brings to the table. But as we move forward into the year, and I mean, I don't think there's any ifs, ands, or buts about it. Rafael Devers' future in the big leagues is as a DH. It could be as soon as this season that he's a DH. So now you're really talking about Masataka Yoshida clogging up and blocking a spot for these prospects, whether it be Bregman moving to third and Campbell slotting in at second base, or Trevor Story going down, Meyer playing short, and they're going to try Meyer all over the infield. So what if Meyer turns out to be a really good third baseman, given his height and length and whatnot? So now you're moving Devers to DH for Meyer to play third. Like, we just can't be blocking these types of prospects and potentially these types of players for Masataka Yoshida. And I understand the money's the money, but like, it's $18 million. You're the Boston Red Sox. Like, the contract has never been that big of an issue for me at all, pretty much. Like, it's a middle of the road contract for a middle of the road bat. Like, it's about the same amount of money that they DFA'd with Pablo Sandoval. Obviously, different circumstances, and I think Moss has been way more productive than anything Sandoval did in a Red Sox uniform. Mm-hmm. But like, if you hate him that much and you are blocking your top prospects and it's kind of fucking with your entire roster alignment, at that point you just cut bait and you DFA him and you say, hey, like, this was a mistake that the, or maybe you don't call him a mistake. That feels like, that feels a little mean.
Bad business.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. But you say like, hey, this is a deal that the last regime signed. This new regime doesn't necessarily see the right fit in what you bring. So like, we're going to cut you loose and hope you catch on somewhere else. Cause like, I think that type of bat does get it, probably not claimed because then they assume all the money, but after he clears waivers, I think that's a guy who picks up somewhere. I mean, he probably just goes to the fucking Dodgers because they're Team Japan at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking like future Pirate, future Red, some low, you know, mid-tier market team who wants another bat. I
the Reds, like that power play. The power probably plays in the Great American Small Park. I mean, we talked about Park Factors Fenway. The Great American Small Park is right up there too for home runs. So like, that's a guy that maybe his power plays a little bit better there. They're looking for an extra bat, someone like that. But it's just, at this point, like you said, it feels like his days are numbered, and I think there's a chance that by the All-Star break, he's just flat out DFA'd.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I texted you about this too, was having Bregman just makes DFAing him that much easier. I know that you are sort of pressed for time. So did you want to talk about the new MLB The Show getting revealed, or save that for next time?
Why don't we save that one for next time, but do you want to touch on the, some of the farm system rankings?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So Kylie McDaniel of ESPN put out, I think it must be a week or week and a half old at this point, but he did a top 100 prospect rankings for 2025. The big three were all on there, as you would expect. Roman Anthony was number two. I think Roki Sasaki was one, and I know you are not happy about that.
Yeah, it's such nonsense.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. It's just, they are obviously not in the same tier of rookie. And I don't think he should be counted, but I don't know where the workaround is there. Meyer was at four.
The same thing with Yamamoto last year. Like, Yamamoto came into the league and was like, all right, here's your new number one prospect in baseball, Yoshinobu Yamamoto. It's like, okay, well, like I understand, but like, Yamamoto was what, 27? Like, he's a 27-year-old, and he's been playing professional baseball for 7 years in Japan. Like, how is that guy? Sasaki's a little bit different because technically he signed as an international amateur, and he's only, 21? So
I think 22, 23, something like that.
So I think there's a better case for him to be considered a prospect, but like next year when Munetaka Murakami comes over, is he magically going to be the number one prospect in baseball now?
Probably.
Like, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that those types of guys are just like, all right, well, they're coming stateside. They must be the new number one prospect in baseball. Like, sure, they are. Like, Sasaki is the top prospect in baseball, but he's not going to spend a second in the minors this year.
No, so, no.
Like, I don't know how you classify them, but I don't think it should be as a prospect.
Yeah, I wonder if they could make a separate ranking list for, like, international players. I don't know if that would be the most, like, politically correct way to do that or whatever. But point being with this Kylie McDaniel rankings list is he put Christian Campbell at 26, which is questionable to say the least. I know... He wrote a big blurb about it, and he was essentially saying that he has all the tools. He's just not 100% sure if he can put it together like some of these other guys.
Yeah, it's weird because he was also super high on Marcelo Meyer, and he's always been on the higher end of Meyer. And I do kind of appreciate his willingness to stray from the like consensus list because, I mean, how many different lists do you see the same – Roman Anthony, Jackson Jobe, Christian Campbell, Dylan Cruz, you see Walker Jenkins, like you see the same general 10 names in the top 10, just jumbled up however you want to put it. I know Anthony has been pretty consistently number one before Sasaki on Baseball America. Campbell was number four on Baseball America. And I understand being lower on the guy and but at this point, we've seen Christian Campbell do it. His big thing was that his swing was funky. That was a storyline when he was drafted, that his swing was weird. So to still, after seeing a year of him tear the cover off the ball, be named Baseball America's Minor League Player of the Year, this, that, and the other thing, like he won however many awards, to still be like, I don't know, the swing's pretty weird, like... Yes, the swing is weird. We've established this. It doesn't matter for him. They figured something out for him where the swing works. He elevates the ball more, generates more power, leading to more home runs, more doubles, and it seems like it's going to work out. I understand being lower on the guy like he is higher on Marcelo Meyer than pretty much everybody that you read because, like I said, I think he had Meyer as the number two prospect in all of baseball, which is a pretty out there prediction. But all the way down at 26 just feels like it feels kind of personal at that point. And I'm sure it's not, but 26 just feels so much lower than every, like I said, in Baseball America, he's number four. So like if he was in, just for reference, Marcelo Meyer's number 15 on Baseball America. So like if he had them switched, like I think Campbell's 15 and Meyer's number two, I think that's more than fair, but I kind of question the criticism of, oh, he's got a weird swing. It's kind of like Javi Baez. It's like, well, first of all, Javier Baez won an MVP. So it's definitely recency bias with Baez, and like obviously things haven't panned out in Detroit for him, but Baez was a really productive player when he was at his peak. It's just, like I said, it feels kind of unfair to be that much lower on a guy, but I do credit him for going outside the box and having a little bit less of a traditional top 50.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend I know nearly as much about prospects as you do. But to me, it I don't know. I don't know about Kylie McDaniel's, like, you know, credibility. I mean, he works at ESPN, so I'm sure he's a knowledgeable guy and a trustworthy guy. But to me, this seems like a little bit of clickbait. I'm not going to lie. Like, 26 just to be different. It kind of reminds me of the one guy who didn't vote for Ichiro. And while he won't come forward, it's still just like, oh, I want to be different, shake things up. That's, to me, where I'm leaning. But again, I don't know much about these prospects as a whole.
Yeah, and McDaniels, I was wrong. He had Meyer at number four as I'm looking at them.
Okay,
now.
Yeah.
But he is kind of, his rankings are always kind of like this, where he has a couple guys that, like, I forget who it was last year, but he had a guy ranked number 50 that wasn't even in the other top 100 pages. So he kind of likes to do a little bit out of the box, things like that, and call his shots on guys. But I just, like you said, it does feel a little bit clickbaity, especially with it being a Red Sox prospect. Like, you can get people fired up about something like that. And obviously I don't have the all three lists in front of me right now to know who it was, but like I'm reading it now, the real issue now is that his swing doesn't fit into how many teams believe swings need to work.
What does that even mean?
It works. If it works for him and it works for the team that he's on and he's putting up the numbers, then what his swing looks like. Like, I remember when he first started to burst onto the scene, his swing was compared to Hunter Pence. Like, Hunter Pence had a really long, good major league career. Like,
he's
like a Hall of Very Good type player. So I don't know. It just feels very nitpicky to me. And like you said, a little bit clickbaity, but like, even, like I said, it just feels like that's what Kylie McDaniel does. Like, he goes out of the box and tries to be early on guys rather than be late on them. And it's just, he's weird. Like, he's got Johnny Farmello as number 45 in baseball. And I like Johnny Farmello. I think he's in the 60-ish range on some of the other lists. But, like, you're talking about a guy who's 20 who tore his ACL last year. I don't know. It's a weird list. It's a real weird list.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess we'll see who's right in terms of rankings as spring training kicks off in what, less than a week now, or I think it's like 9 or 10 days.
Yeah. I think the Northeastern game is the 22nd. 21st.
So next weekend.
Yeah. And then Grapefruit League play kicks off like right after that.
Yeah.
Do you watch spring training games? Do you watch spring training games?
Admittedly, as like when I was in college, I didn't, just because the semesters were kicking off. But now that this is sort of my entire life, I think I will a lot more. Do you?
I watch sparingly. So like,
yeah.
Like, when I was in college, if there was a spring training game on in a class that wasn't, like, an absolute necessity for me to attend, I'd be like, all right, well, guess I'm watching this spring training game instead of going to class. Sorry, anthropology, but there's spring training baseball to be watched. Now I kind of pick and choose based on the lineups. Like, we obviously, a lot of the time, they don't send a lot of their regulars to road games because they bus.
Yeah.
So, like what veteran is going to be like, oh, yeah, sign me up for this 3-hour bus ride. Now that we have the big three kind of knocking down the doors, I'll probably watch at least every game that they're going to play in until they're out. So like, whether that be like 5 innings or whatnot, or I'll keep an eye on Twitter. If they're subbing into games and getting at bats, I'll tune in for that. But I'm not, certainly not locking in for 9 innings of spring training baseball, because like we all know, by the 8th, 9th inning, it's who the fuck is this guy at every single position.
No, I agree. But once opening day hits, I'm going to be locked in on all 162, especially now that I have more time to dedicate to it. This is the most excited I've been about a Red Sox team in a long time, probably since 2018, because even in 2021, you weren't expecting that deep playoff run.
No, not at all. And I said this yesterday when I literally was driving into work yesterday, and I was just like, fuck, man, like, let's fucking go. Like,
we got
like a month and a half until opening day. We got Bregman, like the AL, like we talked about, is just so wide open. Like, it feels like a year where we could be looking at a pretty deep playoff run. And like you said, and we haven't had one of those since 2021. And that one kind of snuck up on you, where you like, they kind of limped their way into the playoffs. If you remember, they needed to win on the last day of the season just to get to the wild card game, and obviously we know what happened from there. And like, honestly, they should have been in the World Series until Laz Diaz fucked them. Like, it wasn't like we weren't sitting here on February 14th 2021 being like, here we go, ALCS year, like, let's fucking go. Like, obviously not. So to have like this kind of hype around the team, and even yesterday while working, it was 8 hours pretty much of exclusive Red Sox talk, and the phone lines mm-hmm. were absolutely jammed. And this was an argument that I heard, not an argument, but this was a discussion I had with Andy Hart the other day about how there's an appetite for baseball in this market. And this is a baseball town at its core, I think, but the Red Sox haven't given anybody a reason to believe that it's a baseball town because they don't do anything. And the inactivity from ownership in the front office just leaves Fenway ripe for a Dodgers parade down Lansdowne, mm-hmm. screaming, thanks for Mookie, things like that. The Blue Jays taking over. Like, when teams like the Blue Jays, and I understand they travel well, but when teams like the Blue Jays are taking over Fenway Park on like a Friday night in July, that should be sounding massive sirens in the brains of ownership. And for the longest time, it really felt like they were complacent with that because fucking Blue Jays fans, money's green all the same. Yep. And yep. now it feels like we've kind of turned a corner where, like we said, the championship window is open. You should be in or winning a World Series within the next 3 years if you're going to continue to go over this luxury tax number. And it's like, it's finally like, all right, now it's go time.
Yeah, yeah. I think couldn't have said it better myself. I think we can leave it there for now. I'm excited for more consistent episodes once the regular season starts, and once things start to ramp up, there will be more storylines to talk about. Like, I feel like for a little bit while in the off season, we were just struggling to come up with talking points. But yeah, that'll get more consistent. And obviously MLB The Show's coming out. We'll touch on that next time. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, like I said, I'm just excited about where we're at. We got 1 month and 13 days till opening day down in Texas. So looking forward to maybe seeing either Garrett Crochet or Tanner Houck. I assume those are the two guys that are going to be in the mix for the opening day starter. And then I'm excited to be at Fenway on April 9th for opening day.
Yep. Yep. It will be a wonderful time to be a Boston Red Sox fan. And we couldn't have said that in the past couple of years. So things are looking up. It's been baseball purgatory for a little while now, being a fan of this team. So brighter times are ahead. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll talk to you guys next time.